in formation on Sunday on a mission to Somalia, where Uganda is taking a lead role in the fight against Al-Shabaab Islamist militants. Weather can be sudden and severe at higher altitudes of Mount Kenya. At 17,000 feet, it is the second tallest peak in Africa after Kilimanjaro. At lower elevations, hyena, leopard, and elephant roam in Mount Kenya National Park. John Burnett, NPR News, Nairobi.
Large crowds are expected this evening in Memphis, Tennessee, to mark the 35th anniversary of singer Elvis Presley's death. A candlelight vigil is being held at Presley's longtime home known as Graceland. Tomorrow is the actual anniversary. Presley died on August 16, 1977, at the age of 42. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 51 years of service to music education, now offering private lesson instruction for students of all ages. They also feature guitars, amplifiers, digital pianos, software, and sound equipment in the Pro Sound Center at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind, we will not be taking calls.
As we pass through life, we make judgments about other people and the things that they do, and we make them very quickly, sometimes without thinking about them very much. To us, these judgments, they feel like the truth, and they feel very obvious, and that can make us very certain that people who see things differently are wrong. Our guest for this hour, Jonathan Haidt, says this is something that's called moral intuition. He says it is something that varies across cultures, including the cultures of the right and left, politically speaking. In this hour of the show, we'll be exploring some of the ideas that you'll find in Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. I think it brings some insight to the kind of political divide that we see in America now, and also make some suggestions on how perhaps we can find some kind of middle ground as we try to deal with the big problems that we face. Our guest, Jonathan Haidt, is Thomas Cooley, Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Stern School of Business at New York University. His book is published by Pantheon. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have email, so you can send along a thought or a question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point, questions are certainly welcome. And Professor Haidt, hello.
Hi, good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
You know, we talk a lot about how we have a difficult time in this country talking about how it is we solve the big problems that face us. But I think one of the things that you point out is that even it's an even bigger problem than that, because it's not so much that we can't agree on how to solve the big problems, it's we can't even agree on what the big problems are.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, because each group sees different threats. This is something we'll get into later, how left and right differ. But imagine that you can see some parts of the light spectrum and I can see others, and you know, you can see certain objects and certain colors and I see others. And the way I feel these days, it's like there's these two giant meteorites headed for the Earth about to destroy us. And one side says, global warming, can't you see it? It's going to destroy us. And the other side says, nah, that's not really real. But then the other side, the right, says, fiscal irresponsibility and the welfare state, we've been screaming about it for decades and decades. It's going to destroy us. And the left says, yeah, well, we could just raise taxes on the rich and that will go away. So, yeah, we got lots of problems, and we don't even agree on what the problems are.
There is this this idea, it's an idea that goes back in Western thought some way, and there, I'm sure that there's at some level in which we resonate with this idea that people are reasonable creatures, that reason is supposed to be in the driver's seat. But the fact is, and you seem to be lining up with others, and there also was a tradition in Western thought that says, no, that maybe we'd like that to be the way it is, but that's not the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. For thousands of years, certainly since the dawn of philosophy in the West, and mostly in the West, more so than the East, we find people like Plato saying, well, okay, sure, people tend to be irrational, and especially women. They always said women are extremely irrational. But if a man were to study philosophy and learn to reason, then he could make good decisions. He could learn to control his passions. And this view lasted right up until the 1990s, that people may be irrational, but that's a lamentable fact that we could change. What happened in the 1990s is that we began to learn just how much our minds are basically built and designed to run as pattern matchers, as intuitive devices. And so if any of your listeners have read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, or if they've read Antonio Damasio's books about neuroscience, the big discovery is that our reasoning is actually not very good even at its best. It's extremely easily pushed around by whatever we want to believe, whereas our intuitions, our ability to make snap judgments, is actually a lot smarter than we ever realized. And the trick is, how do you put the two together? But it certainly is not the way that Plato said, where you basically just let reason run everything.
Mm-hmm. So that perhaps then brings us to this problem that if you were trying to discuss a big problem with somebody else, particularly if you are trying to persuade them to come over to your point of view, the initial impulse would be, well, what you need to, you can marshal a series of rational arguments, and that if you lay it out in a neat and orderly way, you will appeal to that person's reason, and then, well, perhaps you can change their mind. But it seems that what you're arguing is that you can't persuade people with reason.
Well, that's correct. Once any sort of passion or group identity is in play. So if you and I are having a discussion about what's the best way to get out to O'Hare Airport at rush hour, you know, sure, I could give you arguments and evidence and you might change your mind. But that's a sort of a factual matter where we both really want to get the right answer. Moral debates are not at all like that. Any of your listeners who are married, who have had a discussion or disagreement with their spouse in which they laid out their case logically and expected the spouse to change their mind, knows that that tends not to happen. What I urge people to do when they think about conflicts and debates is think about much more indirect means. If people want to agree with you, they'll find a way to agree with you. And if they don't want to agree with you, no matter what you say, they'll find a way to doubt what you say. So in our political discussions, part of what's going on nowadays is that trust in each other, trust in the other side, trust in our institutions has plummeted. This means that when people give us a reason, oh, do our policy, this will lead to these good outcomes, we don't believe them. When the other side says, well, we think the evidence on global warming is weak, we just question their motives. Persuasion needs to take indirect means, not so much direct means.
Our guest, let me introduce again very quickly, Jonathan Haidt, is a professor he's the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Stern School of Business at New York University. He's a psychologist by his academic training. He's the author of the newly published book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Pantheon is the publisher. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So then if people really aren't so much governed by reason, or what happens is that people have a kind of emotional, intuitive reaction to things, and then they marshal reason as a means of justifying what it is they feel, then maybe the question is, well, this thing that you call moral intuition, this thing that's the basis for this immediate sort of reaction we have to certain sort of things, then the question is, well, where does that come from, or what are the basic elements of that?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So that's what I'm trying to do in my book. In The Righteous Mind, I developed the analogy that the moral mind is like a tongue with six taste buds. If you want to know why do people like the foods they like, what you'd have to do is you'd have to say, well, because we have tongues that have these five different kinds of taste receptor on it, and then you could say, where do they come from? And the answer is, we evolved to eat fruit and meat. That's what we do as primates. As primates that began to eat a lot more meat in the last million or 2 million years. So We have a taste receptor for sweet and one for sour, and you put those together, and that makes us very good at finding fruit that is ripe, not unripe. And now let's look at the moral sense. What are our moral taste buds? And if you look around the world at the kinds of things people care about, what you see is, well, everyone cares about fairness and catching cheaters. People care about group loyalty. People generally care about respect for authority. There are a bunch of things that we really care about and we have strong feelings about, and they fit with the fact that we know that our ancestors lived for a very long time in small groups with intense gossip, in which people would cooperate on a lot of things, but they would also cheat each other and try to deceive each other. So we lived in these complex worlds of gossip and intergroup conflict, and we have, as it were, moral taste receptors that help us navigate those worlds. So that's what I'm trying to do in the book, is lay out what are the taste buds of the righteous mind.
Yeah. And what's really interesting, I think, if you can, I think, view this, or at least a number of these things, through the evolutionary biology lens, the way we like to look at a lot of things nowadays, and you can understand that, oh, say, because human beings are vulnerable for a long time, we have to take care of them. So that would make sense that we would have this value of taking care of other people. If we think it's important, it was important to human survival to be able to work together in groups, well, then a value like fairness would be important. I mean, we don't like people who are cheaters. We don't like people who think they're going to get a free ride. We think everybody should do their bit. We don't like bullies, and I think also, as you point out, that what will happen in groups is that groups will band together to fight people who are trying to take over, and so and you can see all of those things in how people live their daily lives, but you can also see them in the dynamics that roil today's politics. And maybe the fundamental idea is here that while everybody agrees that all of these things are important, different people place different emphasis on various of these things.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So what we find empirically, that is, when we do research, my colleagues and I have a website at www.yourmorals.org. So we've collected about 250,000 people have given us data there, and we work in the lab as well. But what we find is that people who self-describe as being liberal tend to give very, very high ratings on questions about care, care, compassion, helping people who are suffering, animals, things like that. And then also on fairness, when fairness is related to equality especially, and also on liberty, especially liberty for those who are oppressed. So those are the core moral commitments of people on the left. People on the right show they love their dogs, they don't want to kill babies, but they give slightly lower ratings on the questions about care and compassion. And their answers about fairness tend to be more about proportionality rather than equality. That is, they're really concerned about people who take out more than they put in. That is, free riders, cheaters. This is what a lot of the Tea Party protests are about. And they care about liberty, but they care particularly about liberty against central government. They're very concerned about the government being the oppressor, whereas on the left, people are more concerned about corporations being the oppressor. So those are the three foundations on which everybody's got. Everybody builds on them, but they use them differently. Mm-hmm. And then there's three more that are much more valued on the right than the left. And those are group loyalty, respect for authority and tradition, and sanctity or purity. Those three support a more sort of groupish, tribal community, more nationalism. And this is where a lot of the cultural issues are, over immigration, protecting the flag, over the legitimacy of spanking your children for disobedience, things like that.
Well, when you lay it out this way, first of all, it seems to make sense, so it's understandable. But when you lay it out that way, and maybe here I'm much more inclined to go back to the old idea that somehow, oh, it should be all about reason, and if we can just sit down and reason together, well, we'll find some kind of common ground. If you look at particularly at this difference in what people who identify as conservative and liberal, what they really think is important, this would almost make it look like that idea that we can sit down and reason together and find common ground. You might as well forget that.
Well, if by reason we mean let's give each other arguments in support of our positions, then I would agree that's not going to be very effective once we dislike each other or distrust each other or feel that we're members of rival gangs. But I think we really can sit down and talk to each other as long as you understand that conversation isn't just giving each other reasons. It's in part just having a human interaction where you see the other person as a human being who is trying to do good, who wants the best for the country. So what I'm advocating is, well, sort of like what Dale Carnegie advocated long ago. Don't just jump in and give reasons. You got to build a relationship, build trust, get the other person saying yes, yes. That's one of Dale Carnegie's old tricks. But basically, I think the most important thing to do is encounter people within networks of friends where, you know, somebody's vouching that this person's not a monster, and in fact, he's a friend of mine, so don't be rude to him. The worst possible way to encounter people is on the Internet, where you're not even using your real name. There are no consequences for being rude. Those discussions are really fruitless and often counterproductive. So there are groups, like there's a group at livingroomconversations.org that is trying to foster like small dinner parties, basically, where you get a liberal and a conservative host, and they invite some of their friends for a dinner party. And this has been the most thrilling thing to me about studying moral psychology, has been that I was a liberal all my life. I always thought that conservatives were terrible people, that Ronald Reagan just wanted to, you know, destroy poor people and bomb the Soviets. But I've discovered, as people always say, you know, well, I met one, and actually, he was really nice. You know, that that not only are people on the other side perfectly nice, but actually, they can teach you a hell of a lot more than people on your side. You actually can learn from them much better than from people who already think the same way you do.
You also go on to say something that I think is interesting and certainly true, and that is. Again, maybe it's looking through the evolutionary biology lens, but the fact that one of the things we would say about human beings is they have shown a remarkable ability to survive and thrive under very difficult conditions. So you have to say that there must be certain things about humans that gave them enough of an advantage so that we've come for good or ill to dominate the planet. One of the things that you talk about is our ability to come together as a group around some sort of central thing, principle, everybody, whatever they're doing, maybe has their own particular role, but it all has a way of sort of fitting together in support of what it is we all consider sacred and important. And people will fight very hard to defend what they consider to be sacred. Again, it seems the problem is with the liberal conservative divide that we have is that liberals conservatives they're what they consider to be sacred is completely different.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So if you'll forgive me one professorial moment, I'd like to just briefly review now that the book is really just based on three ideas. There's just three big ideas in the book. The first is intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. And so we talked about that at the beginning. The second is there's more to morality than harm and fairness. And that was the stuff about the six moral taste buds. And then the third principle is the one that you just alluded to, and that is morality binds and blinds. And so this is the idea I'm most excited about because it's one that I think people haven't been reading in the popular press and the science writing over the recent decades. And the way I think about it is this. If you look at all the other animals on Earth, none of them can cooperate very well except for bees, ants, wasps, and termites. They are just amazing at cooperation because they're all siblings. They're really all in the same boat, as it were, and they've got to work for the good of the hive. You get elephants can cooperate a bit, dolphins. You get some that can cooperate in very small groups, but they tend to be siblings also or kin. Only humans were the only form of life ever to appear on Earth in which large numbers of people can work together that are not relatives. It's a miracle. And we're so good at it that we're able to form cities and nations and we're able to work together in business. So, you know, a lot of people love to lament how terrible things are going and how we're at each other's throats. But I take the long view and I say, well, you know, as animals here on Earth, we ought to just be sort of either ignoring each other or killing each other. Yet we're actually, for the most part, working together pretty well. So the long trajectory of history is greater cooperation, declining war. Part of what lets us cooperate is that we're able to come together around shared values. So to understand any conflict, it really helps to understand what are the two groups circling around? What do they hold sacred? And in this country right now, we have a culture war of a sort in which the right is organizing around the American flag and the Bible and the founding fathers. They hold up a lot of symbols of God and country. The left, historically, at least in the last 20, 30 years, has tended to rally around Martin Luther King or issues of liberation, freedom for various groups, women's rights, gay rights. So both sides are pushing to make the country better, but they're rallying around behind different standards, as it were, different sacred values.
I'm interested in this idea of groupism as being a fundamental human thing, and maybe it's just because not all that long ago I talked to E.O. Wilson. I've actually had the fortune enough to talk with him a couple of times, but he just has now published a book that I guess in his circle, in the biology circle, has been a little bit controversial, maybe more than a little controversial. It sort of proposes this argument that in the past we've always said, well, what's the prime thing that drives living things? And we say, well, the prime thing that drives living things is to see their biological material advanced. And so that's why it is that people, animals and maybe people, will do anything for the survival of their children. And then past that, it might be, well, maybe you don't have children, but you have siblings who have children. So you'll do that. They're still related to you. So you're going to do whatever you can to advance the genetic material of people who are close to you. But he makes this argument and says, well, really, humans, interestingly enough, will do things to advance the genetic material of people that aren't related to them at all. And that he makes this argument that tendency in humans for good or ill, perhaps is the thing that has enabled them to survive and to dominate the planet as they have. And I think you, in a sense, make some of the same kind of argument that that only human beings create these very large groups of people that aren't biologically related to live, to work together to some sort of a common goal, and that's everything from corporations to armies to sports teams.
That's right. So I draw on Wilson quite heavily in my book and in my thinking in general. Each of us who are studying human nature, we come from some area of expertise, and for Wilson, it's the study of the ants. He spent his whole life studying the ants and other social insects. And boy, if you study the ants, you've got to marvel at how they are able to divide labor, work together, and do astonishing things, build gigantic towers for termites, let's say, or form these enormous supply chains. What Wilson points out in his book, I think it's really brilliant, is that there are actually a few dozen species on Earth that have made the transition from living in a solitary way to living in a groupish way. And in every case, what he points out, and this was news to me, in every case, the trick is that they had a shared defensible nest. So, you know, you can have dolphins out in the water that can cooperate in small groups, but never in very large groups. It's only when you get animals that work together to build something, like prairie dogs or something like that, or naked mole rats, they dig these elaborate tunnels in the earth. And then once you've put all this investment into creating a kind of a house for yourself, well, your children are better off staying behind than they are moving out and trying to create this new expensive nest. And so once you get creatures like bees and ants and naked mole rats that create these nests, you get this huge jump up in sociality, this huge jump up where they can now form these gigantic groups. And what Wilson says is the same thing happened to us. I think it was about 500,000 years ago when we domesticated fire. We started having campsites and fire and larger tools or more powerful tools that let us hunt better. And so once we start getting much more cumulative culture, it's as though we go through this transition from to being able to function as much larger cooperative groups. But of course, once you do that, then you start competing with other cooperative groups. You start getting more intergroup warfare even and violence. And once you do that, then you start getting more tribal to defend your group and to bind your group together. And then you get more religious. You get you get much more ancestor worship and worship of rocks and trees and sacred sites. And you get a kind of an arms race, a cultural arms race between neighboring groups. So it might sound kind of ugly when we look way back and see how important war was for our origin. But the miracle to me is that we're able to live nowadays with only occasional wars here and there, and for the most part, we live very peacefully.
Our guest in this hour is Jonathan Haidt, and he is the author of the book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. We have someone to bring into the conversation. Other people are listening. You're certainly welcome. Share your thoughts with us. Ask questions. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have somebody here in Champaign to talk with. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. 2 points here. One is that in terms of the influence of special interest, a lot of money, you know, in the political system.
Yes.
And there's a tendency then, it seems to me, is especially, I guess the Republicans, sometimes named as the party of the rich, you know, they made all kinds of, you know, at one time the Democrats weren't quite as good at getting the money, but now I think they're maybe up to that level. And so, you know, we're not really representing we the people when it comes to that issue. So what would you suggest there?
I agree. You put your finger on what is possibly the most serious and somewhat correctable problem in our democracy. I tend to study the moral motives, the degree to which people are pro-choice or pro-life, and the way this pushes around policy. But you're absolutely right. The big drivers of a lot of our laws are basically self-interest of corporations and unions and other groups that can marshal massive amounts of money behind them. And it's just terrible. I mean, it's really hard to understand how we let ourselves get this way. This is the kind of corruption that complex systems are prone to. And I think it's a problem in that there is really no oversight over Congress. Only Congress can really change this. And the only kind of oversight there is over Congress is the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, this particular Supreme Court has been very hostile to efforts to regulate elections. And I think we're really stuck. I don't know what we can do about it now that the Supreme Court has come down on the side of big money. It is true that the Republicans are to some extent the party of the rich in that as people get richer, they do tend to get more Republican. But the Democrats, as you seem to realize, the Democrats have been quite good at shaking down businesses and other organizations for money. So both sides really, you know, they're in an arms race, and boy, they both use every tool they can to shake down the money.
That's a tough one. And the other one, I mean, I see this as a real moral issue, you know, from the standpoint. The next one is, what would you do as an example? This issue of global warming, and the way I perceive it is that, yeah, they're talking about, you know, the short run, you know, deficit. So like, we're talking about big money if some changes aren't made, you know, as soon as possible or in the next, you know. So how would you, you know, as a strategist or, you know, within the framework that you're talking, which makes a lot of sense, what you're talking about, the emotional part.
Right.
How would you address this thing to get the parties together? And I'll just let you. I'll go off, you know, the phone here and let you discuss that.
Okay. Sure. Thanks. Sure. Global warming is a difficult problem for several reasons. For one, once it became a partisan issue, that pretty much guaranteed that the Republicans would get off the boat. So the left has always been more concerned about ecological questions than the right. By always, what I mean is back since the 60s. Obviously, Teddy Roosevelt was quite wonderful 100 years ago in creating the national park system. But since the 60s, the left has generally been more concerned about ecological issues. As I understand it, the right was generally coming along on the issue of global warming about 10 years ago, up to about 7 or 8 years ago. And then a variety of things happened as it became more of an issue for the left. And then we had that ClimateGate scandal, which wasn't much of a scandal, but it gave the whiff of conspiracy, which gave the right permission to disbelieve. it's not as though there was really any new evidence, but now suddenly here were some researchers who had maybe altered some graphs, and suddenly, oh my goodness, see, it's all a hoax. So part of the problem is just once we have this bitter partisan warfare in which, as I said before, we are coming to trust each other less. Research on or polling on what people think of the other party has shown that while they've always had a somewhat negative view of the other party, in the last 5 or 10 years, it has plummeted. People really hate the other party. So the very partisanship of it makes it hard to solve. But even more than that, even if we could solve it in America, suppose we could get our CO2 emissions under control, this is a kind of a social dilemma, kind of a problem for which there is really no easy solution. That is, even if we get under control, China and India are not going to. It's been almost impossible to get any nation to make any kind of sacrifice to address global warming. So I think that there are some interesting people at what's it called, Breakthrough Institute. If you look up Breakthrough Journal and Breakthrough Institute, they argue that we're never going to get China and India to play along. It's hard enough to even get us to play along. The only real way out of this is to make energy so cheap, new energy forms so cheap, that that carbon-based forms are just now too expensive. And I kind of agree with them. I think politically the problem is unsoluble. But economically, if we could ever get that breakthrough in nuclear fusion or in battery storage that would make wind and solar energy viable, I think that's where we should be putting our money. We got to somehow make carbon-based fuels obsolete.
We're talking in this part of Focus with Jonathan Haidt, author of the new book, The Religious Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Voter ID laws have cropped up in many states as the 2012 election approaches. Do they suppress votes or prevent fraud? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nate Persily, a professor of law and political science at Columbia University, and with State Representative Daryl Metcalf, who sponsored Pennsylvania's voter ID law. It went into effect this year, but is under legal challenge. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
In this hour of Focus, we are talking with Jonathan Haidt. He is Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Stern School of Business at New York University. He is author of a recently published book. The title is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Pantheon is the publisher. We have a number of other callers here to talk with. We'll go next to our toll-free line. This is Piatone, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting topic. We were talking about environmental issues. Well, I've had a chance to work with the government. I used to work for the Forest Service for years, and I can take account for seeing firsthand what the public does as far as trash in places. They're no more interested in saving the environment than anything else. It's kind of horrendous because, having dealt with replacing stuff over and over and over again because they just feel like it's a need to destroy things, it's insane. One thing you brought up is as far as going away from carbon-based situations, I don't see how that's going to be possible. You might be able to get people off of gas, but pretty much most of the stuff that's made out there, all the plastics, all the greases, they're all made from, guess what, petroleum products. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've got a graph in my office that shows this. I have a friend of mine that works for an oil company. A small portion of that oil that comes out of a tanker is used for gas. The rest of it, the bulk of it, is used for chemicals of different varying kinds, drugs, plastics, carbon-based stuff. I mean, I don't know, unless we're willing to live back out of paper bags and I don't see it ever happening. I do see a need to enhance or stress the fact of recycling in everything. I'm a contractor, and I pretty much recycle 99% of what I take out, with the exception of drywall and some other things. But I've spent the time and the effort figuring out how to get rid of this stuff. And I think instead of putting in huge dumpster bins, I don't know why people just don't set it out. You know, I have metal collectors because God knows we all need, you know, money nowadays. There's a lot of recyclers out there looking for stuff like this, metal, copper, steel, whatever. I was wondering what your take is on this.
Sure.
And thanks again, Dave, for a great show. Bye.
Yeah, sure. No, thanks for the question. So first, in terms of getting us off carbon-based fuels, I don't doubt that you're right that so much of the oil is used to make other stuff, but that's not the stuff that destroys the atmosphere. If you change it from oil in the ground to plastic in a, you know, in a kid's playroom and then into a somewhere in a dumpster after that, it doesn't go into the atmosphere. The big problem with the atmosphere is our fuel usage, and it's mostly from coal and then natural gas. Coal is the worst of all offenders. Anything we can do to get off coal is a huge step in the right direction. And that's where fracking becomes possibly helpful while also controversial. On your points about recycling and how people trash the environment, first of all, most people who go to the parks, I'm sure, treat them quite well. But, of course, you as someone who worked for the Forest Service, you see the terrible things done by a small minority of people. But it does point to, I think, the importance of reputation and monitoring in making people behave well. Most people behave pretty well most of the time. But if you want people to behave really well, make them feel as though they're accountable, as though somebody might even see them. There's some amazing research showing that if you have say a coffee station in your office and it's an honor system and everyone's supposed to put in a dollar when they take a cup of coffee, well, if you put some little stickers that look like eyes, like, you know, eyes looking at you, if you put some little stickers that look kind of like eyes nearby, you get more money put in. That is, people are more likely to deposit their dollar if they think, even unconsciously, that someone's watching them. And this, of course, is a big problem out in nature, out in the parks. People know that nobody's watching, and some people, a small minority, will behave abominably and selfishly.
Well, again, I want to thank the call. Let's go to another caller here, line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I hope I'm a little bit closer to being germane than the last caller. But your analysis of American politics, I think, deserves some examination. Franklin, Theodore Roosevelt, of course, was a Republican, but he was a liberal.
Yes, well, progressive, yes.
A progressive and a liberal. Of course, the progressives were the farther left of the liberals. But almost all of the Republicans and Democrats until the late 1960s were liberals. Everett Dirksen may have been called a conservative by Franklin Roosevelt, but he was very much a classical liberal, as were the Tafts most of the time. Certainly the New England Republicans, Lodge and his cohorts, these were all liberals, mostly classical liberals. That is, they believed in laissez-faire economics. But basically, they were not that different from their Democrats, and they were able to cross over and form alliances and work for the common good. What happened in the 60s, the conservatives, who had been almost exclusively reactionary Southern Democrats, captured the Republican Party. From that point on, you had two irreconcilable groups, and it is that, as much as anything, which has caused the impasse we face today. These are
you're right, and I do say that in the book. I trace out the history.
Well,
go ahead.
I'm very glad you do, and of course I recognize that it's very difficult to develop the entire thesis of a book on an hour program. But I think that is often neglected. People don't understand the reversion of the parties, that the liberals had been the Republican Party. It was founded as a Republican Party by people like Lincoln and Carl Schurz and others.
The one thing that I would add to that is to say it's not that they were all liberal, it's that there was a liberal wing and a conservative wing in each party, and that made it very easy for friendships and bipartisan coalitions to develop across parties because there were people in the two parties that often saw eye to eye on specific issues, and that was a very healthy state of affairs. The one thing that puzzles me, though, is when I look at the graph of party polarization, that is, the degree to which voting in Congress was entirely along party lines, and people weren't free to vote their conscience or go off on their own, what we see is that party polarization was extremely high throughout the 19th century, and then it plummets in the 1920s and 30s, and as you say, it stays relatively low until the 60s, then it begins to rise, and it speeds up a little more in the 80s, and it's sped up even more since about 2000, 2001. And so the good news is it can't go any further because Congress is now as polarized as it is mathematically possible to be. So things can't get much worse. But what we have to realize is that this period of the post-war, the World War II period and the period after, while it seems like there was a lot of civility in Washington, and there was, this was the temporary anomaly. It was a kind of a temporary dip of a few decades between a 19th century that was terribly polarized and then a late 20th century, which also has been terribly polarized.
I think there's a third group that we need to consider. The politicians who really have no ideological bias. Karl Rove, I'm sure, would be just as happy to be known as a liberal as long as he had power.
And, well, I don't know. You're right that power is – there are many who prefer power over anything else, but I think there is a kind of a psychological affinity. Some people find themselves drawn more towards conservative ideas and values, others towards liberal ideas and values. And I think that for the first time in American history, we have that split where the two parties represent the psychological liberals in the Democratic Party, the psychological conservatives in the Republican Party, whereas in the past, the parties were always – complex coalitions of regions and industries. So if we go back to Lincoln's time, I don't know this for sure, but I'd be very surprised if all the psychological liberals were in the Republican Party and the conservatives were in the Democratic Party. That is something new now, and that makes it easier for us to hate each other because the people in the other party really are psychologically different. They like to eat different foods. They drink different beverages. They watch different movies. We really are like different tribes now between the two parties.
I need to jump in here. We just have about 5 minutes. I have one more caller I'd like to try to get. I want to thank the last caller and go on to Effingham here for line four. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Line four? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. I heard your guest mention a bit ago about war and how that occurs with ants, and then we ourselves as Homo sapiens kill one another of the same species. Now, is he saying that is throughout all life that the same species will organize themselves? And he mentioned tribalism, which I'm thinking that all that occurred after male dominance, but does he then suggest that is an integral part of all species? I'll ring off and thank you.
Right. No, it is not a part of most species. That is, most species are not terribly social. They're not able to work together in groups, and therefore they don't have intergroup competition. Primates are pretty social creatures. Some, like orangutans, live mostly solitary, and I'm pretty sure they don't engage in any kind of intergroup competition. But chimpanzees are pretty good at forming a troop, and they do patrol their borders. They do kill the males from the neighboring group. Bonobos are similar but less violent, but they are also territorial. So we social primates, the chimps, the bonobos, humans, were very good at forming troops, guarding territory. And as long as you have that going on, then you're going to have intergroup conflict shaping the evolution. What I was suggesting was that humans bumped it up to a new level, a level that has only been reached by the bees, ants, wasps, and termites before, that no other mammal has really achieved this level of ability to work together, form a group, and therefore compete with other groups, perhaps violently. So I'm just saying you need to take account of intergroup competition for some species, and we are one of those species.
Just coming down to our last 3-4 minutes here, I come back to the idea of this question of why it is that politics is so difficult, and the fights can be so bitter and so bloody. It does, and I think this you laid out this way, is that deciding who you're going to support as a candidate or who you're going to vote for, it's not like deciding what kind of refrigerator you're going to buy. It's not that kind of decision at all. It's more like deciding what church you're going to go to. And given that, and again, given this tendency of human beings to surround and want to defend their sacred objects, is there anything that, people who are on the extremes of the political spectrum that can actually bring people together into the same sacred space?
For people on the extremes of the political spectrum, no, I don't think so. Those people are so bound up in their moral worldview. They see people on the other side as so evil. They are so certain that they're right. So I think there's really nothing that can be done for the people on the extremes. What I'm hoping we can do is reduce the influence of the people on the extremes. So if listeners will go to a website I've created called civilpolitics.org, we have some suggestions there and some analysis about civility and the causes of its decline. So, for example, since we run party primaries in this country, mostly they're closed party primaries, so only the Republicans vote in the Republican primary, only the Democrats vote in the Democratic primary, and that gives the extremists a big, big influence because they're the ones most likely to vote. So they pick candidates for the House of Representatives in particular who are more likely to be extremists. What I'm hoping we can do is make an end run around the extremists, because most of us are not extremists. Most of us do lean one way or the other, but not terribly strongly. Most of us don't think that the other side is the devil, but politics is mostly fought out by the people who are passionate, the people who are more at the extremes. And then, given the hugely rising role of money in recent decades, those extremes are amplified, given ammunition, they can file more lawsuits, and just the whole game, it's sort of like, you take two bands on the playground that are fighting each other, and you give them all automatic weapons. Boy, it gets ugly quick.
Yeah. Well, going back to something we discussed a little bit earlier, you talked about the fact that one of the things that you did was you tried to look at a lot of people, a lot of different places around the world, and look at how people thought about morality. What really are the core values? And you said you came up with basically six things: care, fairness, liberty, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. And that while your argument is, while liberals and conservatives say they would believe in all of these things, that liberals particularly believe in care, and maybe really that's the most important value, although the other things in the top, in the three do matter to them,
yeah.
To conservatives, really all six matter equally, and in fact they may indeed place greater emphasis on things like authority and sanctity and loyalty. So, and I know this is not the intention of this book. It's not one of those books that's aimed at Democrats and liberals and to try to tell them how they can get people to support their agenda. But if I ask that kind of question, is there anything in here for the left if they're interested in trying to get more people to support their agenda? Do they actually have to look at how they can address these other values, particularly numbers 4, 5, and 6?
Right. Yes. In fact, that's how I got into this field originally, was in 2004. I was a lifelong Democrat, and I saw the Democrats. It seemed to me they were screwing up in 2000 and 2004. They were just failing to connect morally. So I began this research actually thinking how my research might actually help the Democrats to win. But while doing the research and reading so much conservative writing and trying to get inside their heads, as would an anthropologist studying a different culture, I came to realize that conservatives are actually right about a number of things. They see different threats. They see the importance of authority and order and tradition and pride in your group. And so I'm now a centrist. I'm now a nonpartisan. To the extent that the left needs any advice or could take any, sure, there's some advice about how they could change their language, but you know what? If you simply change your language and you just start talking with more conservative values, you're just going to look fake. People are going to see you as being insincere, and this is something that Democrats are quite good at, is looking, seeming insincere. What I'm trying to argue is that both sides really need to step back, get a little more humble, and realize that they're often wrong about a lot of things. I think some of the commitments made in the 1960s were important at the time, but they need to be rethought. I don't think there's an easy fix for the Democrats in the long run. I think they're going to have to really think about what they stand for and evolve into the 21st century, just as the Republicans made some major changes in the 70s. They got their message right. They got it very, very coherent and compelling. Reagan was the bearer of that message, and they have not had to update it. It's worked for them for 30 years.
Yeah.
Democrats don't really know what they stand for philosophically, as far as I can tell. And so I do think that there's no easy fix, no cosmetic fix. I think they need to do some serious rethinking.
And I think that's interesting because it goes back to loyalty, authority, and sanctity, that this is something of a generalization, but I think there's some truth to it, is that as Democrats tend much more to go their own way, I mean, as you get a bunch of Democrats together, they're all going to want to go off in different directions, and Republicans are much better at all hanging together on whatever they agree their core principles to be.
Exactly. As Will Rogers once put it, I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Well, I think we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have a couple of people that we cannot take. But I would suggest if you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book that we've been talking about. The title is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It is published by Pantheon. And again, there's a website if people are interested in that they might take a look at?
Go to righteousmind.com. There are reviews, videos, excerpts, all sorts of good stuff there.
All right, and our guest, Jonathan Haidt, he is the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Stern School of Business at New York University. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, Dave. This is a lot of fun.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Solving malnutrition in Africa isn't just a matter of providing more food, more calories. Now the focus is shifting to foods with specific nutrients.
We realized that orange sweet potato that is eaten in the U.S. could really provide a lot of vitamin A for the people in Africa.
Battling malnutrition with the orange sweet potato, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support comes from Wesley Church and Wesley Foundation at Green and Goodwin. Free Connect gatherings and dinner for new grad students, faculty, and community members with information on area resources held August 17th. Worship services Sunday at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. Details at wesleyui.org. Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. Stuart Peterson develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information at stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we head into the last several hours of grain trading for this session. And as we look at the futures charts, we see that soybeans are very much the leader to the upside. They're sharply higher, extending their overnight gains. They were a little softer off the opening bell, but since have rallied back. The market supported by tight supply outlooks and what also appears to be fairly firm cash basis at the Louisiana Gulf. The Gulf is up today, sparking ideas of that we're going to see fresh export demand. And there have been rumors that China has purchased several cargoes of soybeans in the last several days. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at 853 1/4, up 1 1/4. Now 1.5. December, 878 1/2, up 1 3/4. March of 13, 890 3/4, up 1 1/4. September wheat, 844, up 4 1/4. December, 863 1/4, up 5. March of 13, 872 1/4, up 4 3/4. September corn,